Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. You are always our most important guest. Thank you for joining us today. This is Jane Karwoski, Dr. J, along with my co-host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico. I'm an experimental psychologist who likes to ponder how social networking and media might be changing the rules you and I live by. Our guest today has studied online games and virtual worlds for almost more than a decade. His study, The Daedalus Project, surveyed over 50,000 online gamers and examined who these gamers are and why they play these games at Stanford University, where he earned a doctorate in communications, and the Palo Alto Research Center. He ran psychology experiments and analyzed large amounts of data to explore how our virtual selves and offline selves are related. Dr. Yi, or Nick, is author of The Proteus Paradox, How Online Games and Virtual Worlds Change Us and How They Don't. Currently, he's a senior research scientist at Ubisoft Gamer Behavior Research Group. Ubisoft, by the way, began in 1986 with five brothers from Brittany, France, and is the creator of the immensely popular game Assassin's Creed. Now, Proteus Paradox was long before that association. However, Nick, it is our honor to welcome you to the Social Network Show.
Thanks, Jane, and thanks, Jim, for having me on.
Well, thank you for being the cutting edge of all this, and what an honor. Thank you again.
Nick, earlier this week you wrote for Future Tense on Slate.com a rather humorous piece about the fact that men are much more likely to switch gender, that is, have a female avatar, than women are to choose a male avatar. At first, this seems very puzzling, but you point out a simple fact of virtual life that goes a long way to explain it. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I think the most surprisingly consistent fact about the gender switching in these online games is that men do it a lot more often. So in games like World of Warcraft, about 23% of men have a female avatar as their primary game character, whereas for women, it's only about 7%. And so the article I wrote up on Slate, the primary goal was to summarize a recent research project that was led by Professor Rosa Marti at the Colorado State University, where they recruited almost 400 World of Warcraft players and then brought them into a custom-made quest to see how they would behave. And they were particularly interested in the players who were gender-switching, again, playing a character of the opposite gender. And what she found was really interesting. She found that of the men who gender-switched, they would change their speech patterns to more stereotypical, female speech patterns. So they use more emotional phrases like amazing, yikes, and they use more exclamation points. And they picked characters who were stereotypically beautiful and more attractive, you know, long, flowing hair rather than a pink mohawk. And so what she found was that the men were essentially creating very stereotypical vision of women as being beautiful and emotional, but where they failed in their masquerade was how they behaved. The men, whether they were gender switching or not, behaved in the way they moved was very different from how the women behaved. So they were walking backwards more often. They were jumping a lot more often. They were staying further away from groups. And so what her article was so fascinating was that even though the men could partially talk the talk, they completely failed to walk the walk. And then what I did in the Slate article was dig a little deeper and really get into, you know, but why are the men gender switching in the first place? And why is there such a huge gender disparity between how often men and women gender switch?
Yes, and you brought up a simple fact about when you're playing a game, where is your avatar in relationship to the view? You're looking.
Exactly, and that was really the key clue for us. Most of these games are played from a third-person perspective, so you're about 10 to 30 feet, it's adjustable, over the shoulder behind the avatar. So what you see of your avatar is not the face in the front, but the back and the behind. And so when you ask the men why they choose to gender switch, the most common reason they give is that if they have to stare at someone's butt for 20 hours a week, they'd rather stare at a girl's butt than a guy's butt. The secondary reasons are they'll say they believe that female avatars are treated more nicely, they're invited into groups more often, and they're given free gifts.
Huh. Yeah. That's interesting, because women who play online games don't necessarily report being treated nicer. But
exactly.
As far as the... And now 20 hours a week is what the average player plays, right?
Yeah, that's the average. And it's been surprisingly consistent over the past 10 years from the EverQuest days through, World of Warcraft. The average number of hours played has always stayed between 20 to 22. And I think it's even more surprising, given that most of these gamers are not male teenagers, who have no jobs. The average age is actually 30. About half of them, 50% of these online gamers work full-time jobs. About a third of them are married, about 20% have kids of their own. So these are mostly normal people with, normal jobs. Mm-hmm. And families of their own, and they're spending a great deal of their time in these online communities.
But as far as the guys, they know they're going to have to look at someone's rear end, and so they just as soon have it be a female. Well, scientific research is sometimes a lot more fun than people think it is. Do you have any other findings that would make us chuckle?
I've always loved the superstition finding, so I'm going to take a step back to this plain old psychology 101. We all know about B.F. Skinner, who's famous for, behavioral conditioning, the idea that if you reward someone for doing something, the likelihood that they'll repeat that behavior increases. It's a really, I think anyone who's taken Psych 101 knows Skinner's work. Mm-hmm. But one of Skinner's most quirky studies involves inducing superstition in pigeons. And what he did was he had, eight pigeons in cages separately, and he would feed them food pellets at 15-second intervals, regardless of what the pigeon was doing. So every 15 seconds, a food pellet would drop out. And what Skinner found was that most of the pigeons developed food-seeking rituals because they believed that the random behavior that they were doing the moment that the food pellet dropped was what caused the food pellet to drop, even though that wasn't true. So there were pigeons that began turning clockwise continuously. There was another pigeon that was hopping left and right. There was one pigeon who kept pecking at an imaginary object at the top left of the cage. And what Skinner was trying to show was that, you could use behavioral conditioning to explain really complex human behaviors like superstition. At first you think, gosh, these pigeons sure are stupid. But online games are a kind of, Skinner box. They're a place where players get constant rewards for different things. They level up, they get rare items. And because of how mathematically complex these worlds are, and sometimes there are bugs, the direct causes of good rewards are sometimes not clear. In fact, they're often not clear. So in games like EverQuest, there were players who developed spawn dances. So when the monster dies, it comes back after a while. Otherwise, monsters would become extinct in these online games. And what a lot of players started believing in was that there were certain character movements that you could get into to encourage the monsters to respawn faster. So there were people who would move around, shift around in figure eight pattern. There were other players who believed jumping was the answer. There were some players who believed that you had to move far away out of the room where the monster was to Payson, it's Respawn. And so across, let me give you another example. So in the game Dungeons & Dragons Online, there's a character skill called Diplomacy. It's a skill that you're supposed to use on the computer-controlled characters. It opens up new conversation options within the game. But there was a bug in the game that allowed players to use Diplomacy on treasure chests. And it was an utter bug. You weren't supposed to be able to do that. But and there was no effect whatsoever. But players who discovered this bug believed, through coincidence, that having a high diplomacy skill would increase the quality of the loot in the treasure chest. And it got so bad that that when the developers came out and said, this doesn't happen, you know, we categorically deny that this happened, and players still didn't believe it. So what the developers did was they took away the skill. So they fixed the bug, essentially. And then there was a huge outcry among the player base. Because
how
said,
dare you
I can't
take
believe
this away.
You've nerfed and destroyed my diplomacy training to be used on treasure chests. You know, so what the book, The Proteus Paradox, is about is how, you know, we believe that virtual worlds are about, you know, freedom, fun, and fantasy, and fluidity. But we carry all this cognitive baggage in, like the butt staring, the way female avatars are designed, the way that these psychological heuristics change how we perceive the world and how we make sense of the world. And that these worlds end up being more constrained and end up more replicating and perpetuating the status quo than really allowing us to play with our identities. And that's really the heart of the book.
I want to ask about why Proteus, what the effect was to begin with, and the paradox. So let's go into that in our next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This moment of uncontrollable laughter was made possible by a 32-year-old man with little to no coordination attempting to execute a simple cartwheel. His name is Sergeant Warner, but young James, our laughing friend here, simply calls him Dad. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, where we are talking with Dr. Nick Yee, who is a researcher in online behavior, especially within virtual worlds and online games. And the question I had, your book is called The Proteus Paradox, How Online Games and Virtual Worlds Change Us and How They Don't. Why Proteus? What is that about?
Yeah. Well, I have a penchant for Greek mythology names, so my older project was the Daedalus project. But I picked Proteus because the Greek god Proteus is known for being able to change his physical form at will, so he could become a lion, a leaf, you know, a raging wave. And the reason why I felt it was fitting is because it really embodies how we see virtual worlds, that in virtual worlds we can become anyone and do anything we want. And the book is called The Proteus Paradox because more often than not, you know, I argue in the book, that promise really doesn't become fulfilled, that we're bogged down by our cognitive baggage, There are a variety of unique tools in these worlds that really constrain and influence how we behave and think. And so that's why I named the book The Buddhist Paradox, is that how our assumptions and myths about virtual worlds may or may not actually be true.
So even though we'd like to think of a virtual world as being something completely different and fantastic and full of crazy imagery and so on, really, and a chance to become someone totally different, it doesn't really happen. That is ironic. Now, what your earlier work had to do with the Proteus effect, and
that's right.
What was that?
Oh, yeah. So the Proteus effect was my studies during my dissertation days, and what we're interested in was what happens psychologically when you give someone an avatar that doesn't look like them. So you put someone in a taller avatar, you put someone in a more attractive avatar. And so we found, you know, within 5 minutes of putting someone in a new but different avatar, the people who were given more attractive avatars would walk up closer to virtual strangers. They disclose more personal information about themselves to the virtual stranger. The participants who were given taller avatars would negotiate more aggressively in a bargaining task than participants given shorter avatars.
This was not just within the world, the virtual world, right? This carried over into the face-to-face world?
Yeah, so we actually did these in immersive virtual reality. So it's like the Oculus Rift, but you can actually walk around. So you had goggles, and we had cameras in the room that tracked your movement. So as you took a step in the physical world, the goggles would actually reflect and render the correct movement. So it's like the Oculus Rift, but with full movement. And so what we did was we did the studies in the immersive virtual reality first, and then we brought them out. And so in the attractiveness study, we did a follow-up where after the virtual portion, we took them out and we told the participants, now you're going to be doing a separate study altogether. We just put these two together for convenience, but you're actually in a separate study. And in the second study, they were in front of a computer, a normal desktop computer, and we put them in front of a site that we had mocked up of a college dating website. And we said, we're testing out how, you know, college students perceive each other on, you know, on a mock-up college dating site. So please go through the website. So they had to fill out their own profile and, you know, really quick personality test. And then they were shown a panel of 9 images of people of the gender that they were interested in. And we said, pick the 2 that you're most interested in meeting. And what we found was that the participants who we had put in more attractive avatars in the immersive virtual reality, in the second task, picked more attractive partners to get to know. You know, again, that was only like a 10-minute outside of the virtual world. One of my colleagues, Jessie Fox, ran another study where instead of the avatar, she created doppelgangers. So there were students who watched an avatar in immersive virtual reality that was modeled on their faces and bone structure. And they would watch their doppelganger either run and exercise on a treadmill for 10 minutes, or the doppelganger would be loitering in the corner. And what Jesse found was that after this 10-minute immersive virtual reality exposure, over the course of the next 24 hours, the participants who saw their doppelgangers exercising were more likely to exercise themselves in the physical world. You know, so we found this host of interesting effects of how your avatar and your doppelganger could change the way you think and behave. And, you know, I get into that into the book as well. And it's the effect that we call the Proteus effect, that we usually think of our avatars as things, as a one-way street, things that we create and control. But it's actually a two-way street, that the avatars that we inhabit come to change how we think and behave in turn.
Now, that experiment, you said one doppelganger, the avatar modeled on us, appearance-wise, was exercising. What was the other one doing?
Loitering.
Oh, hanging around, doing
just
nothing.
Just like I'm doing
couch,
right now.
A
I'm
couch
loitering.
Potato.
Yes, like I'm
okay.
doing.
Well, now see, that gets into what Jane McGonigal is so adamant about, that feeling that putting yourself in an having an avatar that has qualities above and beyond what you have can make you a better person. But I know that you're not all that optimistic on that. Can you explain why not?
I think the best way to think of games and game mechanisms and gamification is that it's really a tool we can harness, but the effects really depend on who is using those tools. So for example, clearly, you know, for someone like Jane, she could develop really powerful and beneficial, positive tools. But imagine if, I give this example in the book that, you know, health insurance is usually, you know, it's at a struggle for employers and employees because the best financial choices for the employees may be more expensive to provide for the employers. So imagine if your employer could develop a game that convinced you to pick the quote-unquote better option. You know, they made it more fun, you know, they created a fun simulation. And of course, you know, these games take a lot of money to develop. So it's not the case that, you know, you or me or Jim could simply go out and make a game of our own. That it's, you know, big corporations, you know, and big companies that can create these games, and whether those companies have our society with best interests in their mind is not a certainty.
Mm-hmm. So again, tremendous power that could be used for the good, but could also be used for commercial advantages that would not be to our. It wouldn't help us save money, let's put it that way. Or you could say the same thing about surveillance. It may be promoted as a means of decreasing or identifying terrorism, but it can also be a big intrusion into innocent people's lives. What do you think will be the outcome of the gaming? Now, you do research for a gaming company. Is the purpose of the research to advance the products commercially, or are they interested in other aspects? What does it mean to do research for a software company?
Jane, I can't comment on that because that would get me in trouble with my PR. So I can't comment on my current job in that regard.
Okay. Well, I know that there's also like Microsoft Research, Google Research, and just
that I can get into. Yeah.
And generically speaking, when internet or technology companies have a research department, are there some spin-off benefits, let's say, aside from commercial advantage?
I think it really depends on, you know, the people they hire and the background they have. So me, I'm a psychologist, so I'm perpetually fascinated by what it means to be human in a digital world. How do our individual personalities get expressed in different ways in these worlds? You know, so I'm fascinated with research, for example, that shows, just by looking at how someone behaves in an online game, can you infer their personality based on those in-game behaviors? To the degree that we can challenge some of the assumptions of game designers and game developers, you know, how might we go about doing that? You know, so for example, at a game developers conference recently, we gave a talk that really challenged some of the assumptions of monetization. So these are games that are free to play. The game is free to download, but then you may have to pay a little bit to get extra items and resources and so forth. And the assumption within the game industry is that people who monetize a lot are impulsive. They're in fact referred to as whales in the game industry, which is a casino term.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're portrayed as being impulsive, and therefore all the game developers create mechanisms within these free-to-play games that are hinged on impulsiveness and frustration. And so what we did in the study was to actually look at the personality using the standard, the Big Five inventory in personality psychology, to actually examine the motivations of these players. And what we found was the exact opposite, that these players, instead of being impulsive, they were in fact older players who were more conscientious, more rational, more cool-headed, And they were making very calculated long-term investment decisions in terms of their monetization, and it was not impulsive at all. But there was a self-fulfilling prophecy that because the only mechanism and the only way we've been thinking about monetization, it looks as if it's impulsive, whereas if you actually profile these players, it's not. So I think for me personally, I'm intrigued by, you know, applying psychological frameworks to understand gamers better.
Okay. And that...
Just brilliant. Just, I mean, I could listen to you all day, man. That's just fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That's Nick Yee, author of The Proteus Paradox and How Online Games and Virtual Worlds Change Us and How They Don't. Interesting to find out that maybe there's less opportunity for real creativity and imagination in the virtual world than we wanted. And you can follow Dr. Yee at Nick_Yee. That's Y-E-E on Twitter. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Jeannie. Thanks again, Jim.
Thank you, sir. It was great. Please come back because, I mean, again, it's just, I've never heard anything like this. You're just brilliantly fascinating.
And thank our listeners for being with us for this edition of the Social Network Show, recorded at the lovely studios of KUNV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas. We'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch with us via the contact link on our page at thesocialnetworkshow.com, where you can listen to more interviews and read the latest on our blog. Please check out our videos, too, on YouTube, where our channel is simply Social Network Station. Please be safe online and off until we welcome you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests, and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.